Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 12 of the TakeCast. My name is Davis Matic. You can find me on Twitter at Davis Matic. I am here on this episode to interview Safedin Ammous, author of The Bitcoin Standard, which you can find on Amazon or pretty much anywhere that you can buy books online. A great read. I actually got it for a friend's birthday as well, and we'll be giving away a copy of the book after this episode comes out. We are, of course, sponsored by the Pat Mayo Experience, one of the best podcasts I could tell you to listen to if you are someone who is interested in actionable advice, fantasy, gambling, betting, golf, pretty much anything that you could want. Definitely give Pat's show a listen, giving it a ratings and review on iTunes. And with no further ado, we will get into the interview with Safe. All right, I am here with Safedin Ammous, author of The Bitcoin Standard, a guest I am very excited to have on, someone whose book I really enjoyed and I think a lot of you are going to like as well. Safe, how are you doing, man?
Very good, Davis. Thank you so much for having me.
Really excited to talk about the book, and something I'm also excited to talk about because you didn't actually really get into this in the book, and it's something I am interested in. You know, how people find out about Bitcoin, their first reaction, and also how they first bought Bitcoin. I've found a lot of really great stories kind of out of this mold of questioning. So I want to know about your journey from economist, you know, to buyer of Bitcoin, to holder of Bitcoin, to author of the Bitcoin Standard.
Okay, well, I was interested in Austrian economics for quite a while. I was interested in gold as money and in the concept of hard money and sound money for a while. And so I don't even remember when I first heard of Bitcoin. It must have been 2009 or 2010. I'm not sure exactly when. But I remember it, you know, from that perspective, hearing about a digital attempt to make a hard money that's similar to gold. And it took me quite a while to be able to get my head around some of the technical aspects to be able to, you know, get a good idea of how it works. I still wouldn't say I understand it technically and all of that stuff. It's not easy to get your hand around Bitcoin, but it took me about 4 years to understand it well enough to really begin to appreciate that this is something quite significant and more than just a little fad that's going to go away.
I don't think that anyone could really blame you for not technically 100% understanding Bitcoin, because even after reading the white paper and all of the things that exist about the philosophy of Bitcoin and the technology of it, the technology is still, I think, even for a lot of people that are philosophical believers, it's kind of unattainable because it is really technically heavy. But something that did come about from reading your book is, I will totally admit, before I read your book, I was an investor, right? Like I had shit coins. I had an account on Cryptopia and Binance with all of these coins that are honestly just vaporware. But in the course of reading the book, I did become someone who really more philosophically believed in the concept of Bitcoin. However, you know, I definitely, like a lot of people my age who have, you know, a classic arts or a liberal arts education, I'm definitely more of like a socially modern liberal, but I do wholeheartedly believe in sound money. So I kind of wanted to get your perspective on how someone who, you know, doesn't really engage with a lot of these very far right-wing ideas but does believe in Bitcoin, how would you, you know, advise that person to proceed with the concept of sound money?
I wouldn't describe Bitcoin as a far right idea. I mean, I think the libertarian idea is pretty independent of the left and right, in the sense that the left and right are political ideologies, whereas, you know, if you think about libertarianism and anarchism, they are, in a sense, anti-political ideologies. So you can't be a libertarian and vote or run for office or, think that government can be the solution to any particular problem. So I personally, you know, my view of libertarianism and anarchism is that it exists outside of the political spectrum. And the reason I think sound money is important or hard money is important is because it essentially ends that game of people trying to control one another's morality and behavior and worldview by simply taking all of these questions from taking these questions from outside of the hands of government. Because when you have government money, when the government is able to create as much money as it wants, well, I mean, it's not like that it creates as much money as it wants, but, you know, when the government has the ability to increase the money supply and manipulate the interest rate and increase lending, it necessarily follows that it is making not just economic choices, but also moral and political choices, because it can choose whether it wants to fund this or that, or if it should fund this war or that war. And all of these things become far easier for government to contemplate, because they become responsible for more and more of the economic production in the economy. And so necessarily then this leads to more involvement in not just economic activity, which creates all sorts of problems you should be familiar with, but also in moral issues and in personal issues. And the government starts trying to legislate morality and telling people how they should live. And, you know, in my opinion, these things have to be individual. It doesn't matter what you think about any particular major political issue. These things, the struggle that you have with them as an individual is to, whatever you think about them, it is to live that way yourself. It doesn't make sense to go around trying to impose it on others, because, you know, if you force people to do virtue, have they really done virtue?
See, and I think maybe that is where my school of thinking, just the kind of the way that I think about the world, kind of due to the very Western liberal education I've received, would differ from someone that is a true believer, not just in Bitcoin, but the society that Bitcoin projects. I think that is what scares. I think that that does scare a lot of people. The society that Bitcoin would be ideal in is one where you kind of aren't protected from the dark impulses of other people. The people that have the most Bitcoin make the decisions regardless of the morality of it. And I do think that is scary for a lot of people and keeps them from being true 100% full believers, because that's a very unequal world. You know, do you see what I'm saying?
I hear this argument quite often, but I think it's extremely wrong, because you know, when the world lives on a hard money like Bitcoin, then someone having a lot of Bitcoin does not affect somebody else, only to the extent that you choose to deal with that person. Whereas in a world in which you have easy money, the people who have access to easy money are able to take away the wealth of everybody, whether they like it or not. And so I think, you know, it's quite absurd to be worried about inequality in a hard money society, because in a hard money society, the only way to continue to remain rich and to continue to have resources is to be very prudent about the way that you use them. In other words, if you're not prudent about the way that you use your resources, and if you spend your resources on things that are not good for people, like controlling other people, then you end up losing your resources and you end up becoming less and less wealthy. On the other hand, in an easy money economy, you allow government and the people associated with government to continue to operate outside of the realm of economic calculation, wherein they can do terrible things and get away with them because they don't have to pay the bill themselves. And so it's quite insane that if you're worried about inequality, you would think that the solution to it is to allow a certain subsection of society to go around having the right to literally and figuratively, but economically, print money and just allow themselves to spend whatever money they need without any sort of sense of cost to it, to themselves, and without any sort of accountability to it. That's really what is the problem of inequality.
I do, I think that that's just something that is a kind of a gap in my education, and I don't know if it's necessarily I don't know if I'm able to kind of wrap my head around all of that. And I do think part of that is my reading of your book was really the first time I'd heard about the Austrian School of Economics. And my question to you is, why is this not really taught in Western schools? You know, I have a college degree. I went to high school. I took my economics classes. I took my macroeconomics classes. Why is your particular school of economics not taught on the same footing as Keynesian economics?
That's an excellent question. The answer to it, of course, can there are several ways to answer it. One important way of thinking of it is that this kind of economics is not conducive to somebody who would like to support a government spending agenda. So, you know, the perspective that you mentioned earlier, which is the idea that if we had hard money, then the rich would just get richer and they would be able to control everyone else. That's the sort of, if you want, straw man that needs to be propagated in order to continue to have a majority of the population believing in the idea that we need to have government spending. But I mean, there are different perspectives, obviously, and the free market perspective gets mischaracterized and misrepresented through presenting, say, people like Milton Friedman as the free market advocate, when in fact, you know, Friedman himself called himself a Keynesian, and he himself believed in the role of government and the central bank, and he didn't believe in the gold standard. So, you know, there are a lot of limitations to Friedman, but it's much better to use him as a sort of whipping boy and caricature for free markets, and to continue to present free market as just this idea that is to the benefit of the privileged few. But that's Keynesian economics. That's 20th century government textbook economics, and it leads to conclusions that are conducive to government. But you know, Austrian economics was one of the most important, if not the most important, economic tradition in Europe leading up to the First World War. And then after the First World War, you know, because of the rise of fascism, a lot of the economists left Austria and they migrated to the US and Britain. But, you know, as a school, it ceased to exist in Vienna. And over time, the scholars kept in contact through informal networks and through networks outside of academia. But now, with the rise of the internet, more and more of their work is being shared more widely, and more people are coming to understand it and appreciate it. In my opinion, I view it as just this is the correct study of economics. You know, as human beings, we've been studying economics for centuries, for millennia even, and we've accumulated a lot of knowledge over this time. And really, the Austrian tradition is the one that preserves all of the knowledge of the previous civilizations and adds to it, and introduced the concept of marginal analysis, which even Keynesian and modern statist economists rely on. It's maybe the founding principle of modern economics, the idea of marginal analysis. That was started by Karl Menger, who was the father of the Austrian school in the 1870s in Vienna. So that study of economics is all about economics as the analysis of human action, how human beings act, what are the consequences, and what are the economic implications of their actions, how human beings decide to act. And it's fundamentally individualist in its analysis and in its conclusions, because it shows you quite clearly how only the individual can figure out what is best for themselves, and that any attempt to coerce the individual into some specific choices or forcing them away from other choices cannot possibly be to their benefit, you know? And that's really the problem with all forms of government intervention in the economy.
Well, in, in my education, and I assume pretty much everyone who's going to be listening to this, their education basically never made it an open question of if the government should be in charge of money. It's just assumed in Western society that the government makes decisions on money and that the government really has the biggest impact on the economy, and that it's not personal choices really that can fix or save an economy. And a really interesting note from your book is that there was a fairly decent sized recession before the Great Depression, and that it was not mentioned at all in this gigantic economic history book that you referenced. And my question to you on that is, why was nothing learned from that specific economic recovery? Why is that recovery in the 1920s completely forgotten by history?
Because it does not really serve the agenda of activist government. And that's really, these are the people who write the textbooks, and that's the agenda they want. And so the 1920 recession was one of the fastest recoveries, if not the fastest recovery ever recorded. It happened quite quickly, and the economy went back into full employment quite quickly. And the government didn't do anything. There was no stimulus spending. There was no monetary policy expansionary, or none of that stuff. There was just a quick recovery. But then later on, in the 1920s, they started carrying out inflationary monetary policy, and that led to the boom in the stock market, which led to the crash of 1929, which is, usually, no matter how much people pore over its details, people always try not to discuss its causes, because that's a pretty inconvenient theory.
Yeah, and I think that makes sense. But let's get back a little bit more into Bitcoin. And this is something I just learned about a week ago. But there are a lot of rumors that these gigantic mining operations, like the ones in China, like these legitimately billion-dollar mining operations, have not sold any of their Bitcoin. So to you, is that concerning? Like this extreme concentration of potential wealth amongst, let's generously call this 1,000 people who could own, 40% of the world's Bitcoin.
Not really, no. It's not really an issue in terms of, because as the value of Bitcoin is growing, this just naturally becomes much bigger. The only way that you can hold this much Bitcoin is if you're making enormous amounts of investments in mining and holding Bitcoin. At the end of the day, somebody has to be foregoing other things in order to be holding Bitcoin. So it costs you real time and dollars and capital in order to build all these mining facilities. At the end of the day, I think this is just one of the many common things that we hear to scare, that we're usually hearing. Of course, miners are making money, but you have to remember they're paying their rent and their electricity and all of their input goods. They're paying for all of that stuff in their own local currency. So they have a lot of expenses to keep paying. They can't take everything in Bitcoin. They have to sell for dollars and yuan and so on. And, if they decide at the end of after they sell, they decide to continue to hold Bitcoin, then the choice to hold Bitcoin is no different from the choice of any individual anywhere buying Bitcoin. There's really nothing different about it. And, when it comes to the issue of the problem of distribution of Bitcoin, the major issue of distribution is that around 99% of the world, probably more, have zero Bitcoin. That's really the issue. So as more of the world begins to get into Bitcoin, the price rises and the people who own Bitcoin today will inevitably start selling and, benefiting from the rise in its price.
Something more recently kind of correlated on the price is the University of Texas released this paper. They actually talked about this on a cryptocurrency podcast I listened to, basically stating that that price rise for Bitcoin when it got to about 19,000 was manipulated using Tether. And so something that I wanted to ask you, well, first of all, before we even get into talking about what the price is, do you even check the price? Or are you such a hodler that it doesn't even matter to you that the USD price of Bitcoin is immaterial to you?
No, I'll admit that it isn't. I wouldn't say it is immaterial. It is. I would not say it is immaterial. I think it is. It matters because the more that Bitcoin continues to rise against other currencies, the more people pay attention to it. This is really Bitcoin's advertisement is the gains that people are making from it. This is why people get into Bitcoin, but then they get suckered in for that. But then they start understanding what it means. They start understanding why they're making such gains, why this form of money is so much better than government money, and then it starts to click, and then they're in it for changing the world or for being part of a better world. Or I guess the more accurate way of saying it is, as an economist, I'm not really trying to tell people to buy Bitcoin. I don't care if you buy Bitcoin or not. I'm not a salesman for Bitcoin. Bitcoin is not one of those shitcoins that needs to have some guy go on stage and explain why it matters. I don't care if you buy Bitcoin or not, because the way that I see it is Bitcoin is economic reality. Whether you and your listeners buy it or not, it affects you and your listeners. It doesn't affect Bitcoin, the way that I see it is that it's just economic reality that's going to assert itself because of its strict scarcity. It's just going to continue to be a more attractive store of value over time. And this is just going to
So I know you said that Bitcoin is an economic reality, but I do believe that, again, a lot of the people listening to this podcast probably will not believe that. They're probably either no coiners or speculative investors. So why don't you explain a little bit more in depth the idea that Bitcoin is an economic reality and that choosing not to pay attention or choosing not to own it is an economic decision in and of itself?
Yeah, so I think the way that I would look at it is that what makes something money is its economic characteristics. It's not anymore its physical characteristics. And particularly, it's the ability of the supply to respond to increases in demand. So in a good that is easy money, if more people demand it as money, its price rises, and that leads to more supply. That leads to the producers trying to supply more and more of it, which then brings the price down. And that's why easy money is lousy money, because people put their money into it, the value goes up, but then its producers can make more of it. So that could be the Venezuelan government, or it could be any metal like, say, copper or zinc or even silver. People start using it as money, it's quite easy for producers to make a large amount of it. In the case of hard monies like gold and Bitcoin, it's hard for producers to make a lot of new supply for various chemical reasons in the case of gold, which you can read about in my book. But in the case of Bitcoin, it's even better than gold in the sense that the supply is entirely predictable. In gold, you can sort of up the supply a little bit by digging more. But with Bitcoin, if 5 billion people are using Bitcoin tomorrow, there will only be 1,800 new Bitcoins made tomorrow. On the other hand, if 5 people are only using Bitcoin tomorrow, there will also be 1,800 Bitcoins made. So the extreme predictability of Bitcoin is quite astonishing in that regard. And it means that no matter how much demand for Bitcoin rises as a form of money, it will only lead to Bitcoin becoming more secure and not the supply increasing. So with Bitcoin, the more, yeah.
I think one of the most common reactions I've had when talking with people about your book is they said it made them want to buy gold. And I'm sure that was not your intention. So what would you have to
No,
say to
on the
people who
contrary,
are?
I think that would probably be a good idea. I would not completely dismiss that. Look, the book is not investment advice, so I would not. I'm not trying to tell people to buy Bitcoin or to buy gold. But I think gold is not to be dismissed as as an irrelevancy. It's still truly relevant as a monetary asset, and it still holds value across time and across countries, and it's recognizable all over the world. So it's definitely not a bad idea. Bitcoin is just a digital implementation of gold. It's got advantages over gold, and it's got disadvantages to gold in some sense. I think both are the best examples of hard money that we have.
Yeah, I think that's true, and I also think that the fact that banks still own a ton of it is, this gigantic argument for owning gold. And I think the fact that people are starting to hoard Bitcoin, what is your reaction to the news that there are basically these gigantic vaults? I think it's called Novogratz is maybe the name of the public vault for people that are buying, millions of dollars of Bitcoin. Do you think that's a positive signal for mass adoption or hyper Bitcoinization?
Possibly. I don't really know about the accuracy of these reports or how much is there. But yeah, I mean, I imagine if you look all over the world, the ability of people to just have a stable store of value, and this isn't something that, you should have as all of your wealth. It's something that you should have as the basis of your wealth, that you can be confident is going to be there so that you can take risks with all of the rest of your investment. That has been taken away. Nobody really has that. If you keep your money in a checking account, you're losing value over time. And so the only way that you can maintain value is that you need to start undertaking risk. But the model of how this operates under a hard money economy is that you would keep a certain amount of money that you knew you would need as your wealth. This is your basic, say, survival for a few years kit. And you would have that in the form of hard money that appreciates year over year. But then everything else you would invest in and you would take risks with because you can afford to, because no matter what happens with it, you always have that fallback option. So this is what I think things would look like in a hard money economy versus an easy money economy.
And I think another thing that I learned from your book about myself is that I struggle with time preference. That's probably one of the biggest things that I felt guilty about reading your book is, there's a lot of money that I've spent, that I've wasted, on bad investments or just frivolous spending when, my time preference really is quite low. And I think that's like a huge barrier that you have to get, especially with people kind of in their 20s, is they have no sense that their money is going to be losing value, and that if they're unable to find sound investments or sound money, they're going to be a lot less wealthy when they're 40, 50 years old. Is that something you notice a lot about people is like really right now we're in this like kind of epidemic of low time preference?
It's actually the opposite. It's high time preference.
Oh, so yeah,
high
time preference is
when you're high time preference is when you discount the future heavily, so you don't really care about the future. Low time preference is when you care more about the future. So yeah, I mean, I agree. I think, in my book, this is something that I've noticed for a very long time. I remember growing up, my grandfather used to always listen to old Arabic music, old Egyptian music, and he would always tell everybody who would listen how music back then was much better than music that is right that we have these days. And even as a child, growing up in the 1980s, I could never really quite refute my grandfather. And I grew up and I liked all of the music that he used to like, because he indeed was correct. My generation's music is shit and his generation's music is very good. And that applies to Egyptian music, but it also applies to American music probably and many, many other things. You see, and if you look at art and music over the last few hundred years across Europe, you see that there's something changing. Today, European or Western music in general or American music, songs are like 2-3 minutes of just somebody making, just referring to some of the most animalistic things that you could possibly want to do with your body. And, you know, it's very easy to make these songs. It's very easy to sell them. The attention span required for them is very short. And I think this is quite indicative of a society that can't think long-term, that focuses its attention on very short-term things. I think this is quite connected to the value of money and to the ability of people to plan for the long-term and for the ability of people to understand the long-term. But I think, you know, technology has this incredible way of correcting for things. You know, our generation, we've grown up in this world in which more and more our time preference was rising. Everybody around us, we were used to just this short-term decision-making and not thinking of the consequences. And from that world, we get Bitcoin, which is just the exact opposite of that. And I think, you know, people who are getting into it from our generation are really being able to appreciate a new way of living, a new way of thinking about life. You know, even I would say even in the music that you listen to, you know, you start thinking about it. I'm only on this earth for a limited amount of time. I should try and make sure that I listen to all the best music that I can listen to and not the whatever garbage is just happens to be convenient to listen to today. So I think, you know, this is what fascinates me about Bitcoin. This is what really draws me to studying it. And this is what I want to spend the next few years examining and studying, I hope.
Yeah, I mean, I sort of would disagree with your point that music has always been of this highest quality and that the art now is bad. I do think that literature has changed a lot. Mm-hmm. I was a literature major in college, and so, you know, I've spent kind of my whole adult life reading stuff from the 20s and 30s, and, you know, I don't really like a lot of the stuff now. But a refutation for that point would be, you know, people really back then, it was all done for patronage. Like most of the art and the music that was created kind of in the Renaissance era, this golden era of creation, was done through patronage. And a counter argument for that would be, can it really be this soulful, expressive art if it's done really only through being commissioned? Does that make it inherently any better or more life-affirming if someone is specifically paying you to create it?
Well, it's not the fact that they're paying you that's necessarily going to make it better, but it's just simply the fact that the people making the payment are doing so freely rather than having bureaucrats spending other people's money. That's really the key difference. So in the era of government money, we also have government telling us what is good art and what is bad art. And this ends up just being another bureaucratic tool in the hands of government, which, you know, they spend on their buddies or for achieving political goals.
The idea that art, specifically like physical art that you would see in a museum, is entirely subjective and things only really get sold because the guy who created it, you've been told he's famous or important, that really hit home to me because that's just incredibly true. Like really the art world is kind of this giant scam, and it's been proven time and time again.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there are many times in which janitors at modern art museums have thrown away expensive installations because they mistook them for garbage, and they are correct. And many other times, people would go into a museum and leave a random object somewhere, and people would come and take photographs of it, thinking that it is an actual installation. It's completely nonsensical. The emperor of modern art is naked, and it only continues to subsist because people just, you know, nobody is, or few people are creating art that is low time preference, that takes a lot of time. Very few people are learning a craft, you know, in terms of learning how to do a hard painting. Everybody would rather do an easy painting and then tell you a story and or try and shock you with it. Nobody wants to do the hard work that goes into it, you know, the 20 years of learning how to paint in order to be able to come up with a painting that then takes you 3 years to complete. This is the sort of art dedication that we don't really see today because, I think, of the time preference. People are just unable to undertake long-term projects.
Yeah, I I know as someone who struggles with that myself, like just the constant bombardment of screens and stimulation, I think that's all related. I think that Bitcoin fits into that. I think that sound money fits into that. And something that we started with, but I want to end with this as well. The biggest wall right now for people to buy Bitcoin, for Bitcoin adoption, is just that they don't really understand what it is. If you kind of tell them that it's digital gold, they get halfway there, but then you start mentioning hash rates and algorithms and mining, and they just get confused. And so something that does already exist on a minor scale that could exist on a huge scale is off-chain transactions. For example, you know, an online casino that I use, Nitrogen Sports, everything that happens on that website is done off the chain, but when I deposit or withdraw, then that goes on the blockchain. And so what I believe the biggest step to adoption would be some sort of token, whether it be a token, whether it be a physical currency, that becomes very simple, USD-like, that takes place off the chain. But then when you make, you know, whether it be a bank deposit or, you know, big transactions, those do take place on the chain. One, do you think that is the missing step to adoption? And two, do you see that as something that is possible in, you know, the next 3 years?
Yeah, I think we're going to see proliferation of scaling ideas, both on-chain and off-chain, that is going to continue to increase the availability of people to hold Bitcoin securely. And this, you know, this is really what I think is the issue with Bitcoin. I mean, it's just not possible to get 7 billion people onboarded onto using public keys and private keys overnight. It's going to take time for people to figure it out, for people to build the user interfaces for it. It's not entirely clear how this is going to play out, but this is really where the entrepreneurship, the role of entrepreneurship is going to come in, and people who are going to figure out what works best. But, you know, I think an important way of thinking about it is that what I try and argue with my book is that Bitcoin is not going to be a consumer technology, most likely. And I don't think that you're going to be buying your own coffee with Bitcoin. But I think because Bitcoin is such an excellent and desirable asset that's going to continue to appreciate likely in the long run against other currencies, effectively it's going to mean that banks and financial institutions are going to use it as a reserve. And so the user experience might not change all that much with financial tools and technologies that you use, but the reserves of the banks that you use could likely change. You know, that's, I think, an important thing to keep in mind with Bitcoin, that, it, you know, it could be like the infrastructure of the web. It's not something that you play with on a daily basis, not something that you touch, but it is the protocol for the exchange of value between computers all over the world. And everybody has an account that they can access in certain ways, and they have ways of dealing with it easily. It's really exciting to sit and think about the possibilities for how this is going to unfold over time.
All right. Safe. Thank you very much for joining us. Do you want to talk a little bit about the book and tell people where to buy it before we say goodbye?
Yeah, well, it's been a pleasure, Davis. I've enjoyed this conversation quite a bit. My book is The Bitcoin Standard, the Decentralized Alternative to Central Banking. It is available on Amazon and, I presume, from Wiley, the publisher, their website. And it's also available in audiobook if you like, and in Kindle format. It discusses Bitcoin as the newest technology of money, the way that I like to think of it. Thinking of different and old aspects of money, what was good about them, what was bad about them, how Bitcoin improves on them, in what ways, and what would be the implications of a society that starts to move online. Or another way of thinking of it is, imagine what we have right now is that we've added a new central bank to the world, and that central bank is the internet's own decentralized central bank, and it's called Bitcoin. So what will the internet economy begin to look like is something that I spent significant time discussing in the book. What would be the effect of this monetary asset on the economy? I'm also on Twitter quite regularly, so my handle is my first name, Saifeddin, Saifeddan. And yeah, that's about it.
All right. Thank you very much for joining us. Everyone give him a follow on Twitter. And actually, I'm going to be giving away a copy of the book, so be looking out for that as well.